What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico is more than just a tropical paradise. It's an innovations paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, Puerto Rico has the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, this is the place to bring it. Find out more at investpr.org/economist.
Hello and welcome to The Weekend Intelligence. You're listening to a free episode. To listen every week, you'll need to be a subscriber. For a free trial of Economist Podcasts Plus, click on the link in the show notes or just search Economist Podcasts in your very favorite search engine. The Economist. I grew up with guns. Cap guns when I was little, pellet guns when I was a bit bigger. A couple miles from where I grew up, there's a shooting range called, no joke, Spray and Pray. The first time I shot a real gun, I was at summer camp, young enough that hoisting a pump-action shotgun was kinda hard. I've been away from America for half of my life now, and it strikes me that America's problems with guns might start with Americans' ideas of them, ideas I had and didn't question. Gun ownership is often seen as a birthright, seen as fundamental to being American. The Founding Fathers wrote it into the Bill of Rights, the Constitution's Second Amendment, second only to the basic freedoms of speech and religion. Back then, they wanted citizens to have a gun at home in case of a sudden outbreak of tyrannical government. By now, lots of people have the legal right to carry a gun in case an argument in the mall parking lot gets out of hand. There's an insidious notion at work here that the best defense against a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. It's a feedback loop that only leads to more. Of the American adults who don't yet have a gun, nearly half say they could see themselves owning one in the future. I'm Jason Palmer, and this is The Weekend Intelligence. This week, guns, and more pointedly, the case for owning one.
The right to bear arms is something that has become, for better or worse, good or bad, a very fundamental part of American existence.
Well, the good guys and good women are starting to feel outnumbered, which is why my colleague, Tamara Jilks-Bohr, has become more than a little gun curious.
That lady's gonna kill up there, girl. So shoot her.
Shoot when
whenever you're ready.
I hit record on my phone as soon as I get to Thistle Gun Range in Spanish Fork, Utah. It's a large outdoor facility surrounded by beautiful, tall, golden-colored mountains. When I arrive, gunshots are ringing through the canyon. Tall weeds as high as my thigh blow in the wind. I half expect to see tumbleweed blowing past. Surrounded by Sheriff Mike Smith and his deputies, almost all of them white men, most of them very tall, and some of them wearing cowboy hats, I feel like I'm in an old Western. I am definitely not in the habit of hanging out at gun ranges. I know next to nothing about guns. I'm here because my editors and I want to learn more about Sheriff Mike's training academy for teachers. We want to understand what, at first glance, seems like a crazy idea. Teaching teachers how to shoot and carry guns into their classrooms. As a former teacher, I taught middle school science in New York City for 5 years. I am deeply skeptical. We spent so much time making sure guns stayed outside of classrooms and away from our kids. We had metal detectors, school police officers, lockdown procedures. It never occurred to me to ever consider bringing a gun inside the building myself.
If someone comes in your classroom, shoot them. And if they leave, great. If someone else steps into your classroom, well, shoot them too.
Hours after I arrive, I find myself crouched down in the dusty corner of a SWAT training facility.
Okay, let's do it.
I have protective goggles on my eyes, earplugs in my ears, and I'm wearing a bulky, oversized bulletproof vest that makes me feel like a tortoise with its shell on backwards. I stare at a 20-something-year-old teacher standing nervously in the corner, tightly gripping a handgun loaded with paint. She's breathing deeply. We look at each other awkwardly. At this moment, I am so glad that I am not her.
How are you feeling?
Stressed.
We are waiting for the sounds of an incoming invasion. Bullets firing, boot-clad feet kicking open doors, defensive shots firing back. Then, we hear them. The teacher slams a door that leads out to the hall. She drags a heavy metal frame to block the door and stands in the far corner, raises her gun and points it at the threshold. The sounds get closer. The invaders are coming any second now. My thighs burn, my breath quickens, my heart races. I can feel my palms sweating. Suddenly, the door flings open. One of the three male officers, covered in protective gear from head to waist, pushes in. Before he can raise his gun, the teacher shoots back with paintball rounds. The first guy is hit. Paint splatters across his chest. He steps back into the hall in search of his next trainee. The teachers are learning how to respond to a school shooting. The officers pretend to be deranged gunmen. The dusty SWAT training room is supposed to represent a classroom. This is just a drill, but it feels so real. What on earth am I doing here? I've got a confession to make. I may have arrived in Utah deeply skeptical of this whole idea, but by the end of my day there, I'd become a convert. Here's what made me start to change my mind. First, I learned that in nearly 30 states in America, people are allowed to legally carry a weapon inside a school building.
So we actually had an active shooter.
Sheriff Mike Smith realized that it was important that these people get properly trained.
I was a chief of police in a city, and an active shooter was called in. It ended up being a hoax, but before it was determined a hoax, the school went into lockdown. About 200 officers arrived at that school and searched the school. In the course of that search, we found teachers that were armed, which is fine. The state law says they can be armed. But the problems we had with it is one of them was a gun in a desk drawer, which is never a good thing. Another one was in a purse in a closet. So as we looked at this and I started to ask questions of the school, I quickly learned that they have a don't ask, don't tell policy. What made me want to put a class like this together is to offer that type of training.
But there was another reason that I started to come around to the idea of people carrying guns into schools, or people carrying guns at all. Before leaving, the training officers were encouraging me to shoot a gun myself. I'd never done this before, and I had absolutely no desire to. The noise was so, so loud. The kickback looked frightening. Many of the teachers looked terrified, and they had actually signed up for this. But the officers were insistent. Friendly, but insistent. And so, here I was.
I'll go ahead and point that gun straight out.
Okay.
You're going to put the front sight post on your target, mm-hmm. and then you're going to line it up in the middle back there. And then go ahead and you're going to put your finger on the trigger, slow and smooth. Yep, just slow and smooth. Just keep adding pressure. Keep adding ounces at a time. Yeah, just keep adding ounces slow.
Woo!
Okay.
Whoa, that was a lot faster than I thought it was going to be.
Okay.
I think I might have actually really liked that. It's a cliche to say it, but shooting that gun made me feel powerful and empowered. Something I had once feared was suddenly not all that fearsome. I've just done something I've been ideologically opposed to my entire life. And suddenly, the idea of me, Tamara, owning a gun has gone from impossible to intriguing.
Today's shooting deaths of two police officers and a paramedic in suburban Minneapolis add to a grim toll. So far in 2024, there have been more mass shootings in this country than we've had days of the year.
I obviously know the stats. I know that, for example, more than 43,000 Americans were killed with guns last year. That there were 19,000 homicides. I know all of that. Believe me, before Utah, I wanted absolutely nothing to do with guns. I grew up in New Jersey, a state with extremely rigid gun laws. Then I went to college and taught in New York, another state with extremely tough gun laws. Next, grad school in California, another state with no-nonsense gun laws. The only time I ever saw a gun was on the hip of a police officer or on screen. Every time I learned about a mass shooting, yet another mass shooting, I would get angry. Why do we even allow these killing machines? Why can't we be more like the UK and other countries with harsher laws? If I could have legally erased the Second Amendment, the right to bear arms, from the US Constitution myself, I would have done it. There is another reason why gun ownership is a tough concept for me. What do you think or picture when you hear the words legal gun owner? If you are anything like me, you are probably picturing a white guy. He might be wearing camo with militia-style gear on top, or maybe he looks more like a cowboy. Maybe he has a long beard. Maybe he's Southern. But in general, you are probably picturing a white guy. Now, what do you see when you hear the words illegal gun owner? If you are anything like me, you are probably no longer thinking about a white guy. You are probably getting images of street violence in a city like Chicago. And the guy behind the gun is probably black. I'm not a man, but I am black. And for that reason, owning a gun for me means something entirely different.
So why are you laughing, Dad?
Because you're asking me to tell you why I didn't let you play with guns. Is that the question?
Yes.
Okay.
Whenever I'm about to do something big or have some big thoughts on my mind, I always turn to my parents for their thoughts and advice. What my dad had asked incredulously when I called him to have a conversation about guns was, why didn't I let you, a black girl in America, play with guns growing up? Really? I know this tone. It's the tone of Dad's disbelief. It's the tone of, I taught you better than to even consider asking me such a basic and obvious question, and I don't even really believe that you were actually questioning any of this. Growing up, I always knew that guns were bad. They could kill people. White friends, Asian friends, had parents who felt the same way. But I also knew that guns, even play guns, were bad for me and my siblings, specifically because we're black. My sister, brother, and I were never allowed to play with anything that even somewhat resembled a gun.
So, for us, your mom and me, it really was about moving the needle to the positive in any way that we could. Right? You grow up in an environment where black people are getting killed just for a nervous twitch. So as a parent, you're sitting there and saying, okay, if I can just move that needle, it makes a difference between my child coming home safely and your mom and me crying over a coffin. So it's the little things that matter. And hopefully, cumulatively, you get to come home every single day.
I grew up on the Jersey Shore in the 90s and early 2000s. My dad had moved to America in the late 70s from Barbados, a small Caribbean island. My mom came shortly after. They had a lot to learn about their new home country. But my dad says that he learned very quickly that being a Black man in America was going to be very different from being a Black man elsewhere. And my dad has lived in many different countries. His father was a minister who was good at building up fledgling congregations, so he was sent to live all over the Caribbean.
Did you always have these feelings about being Black in America, or did it take time?
I think I realized very quickly that there were different rules throughout every aspect of life in America for me, and I needed to understand those rules very quickly if I were going to survive. You're actually working in America to get to neutral, because the immediate sense is one of fear, apprehension. You're working to disarm people. That takes a lot of effort every single day of your life.
So for my parents, who spent every day working hard to get to neutral, who spent every day teaching their Black kids how to get Americans to feel neutral about them, lots of things were forbidden. Hoodies, sports jerseys, baggy jeans, braids, and many other things that they thought would be just too poorly perceived by white people. Toy guns were especially forbidden for us. My parents always warned us that something bad could happen to us if someone saw us with a toy gun and thought it was real. They didn't even want to think about the consequences.
And we're following new details on the Tamir Rice shooting case. The 911 dispatcher who responded to the call has been suspended for 8 days. A white police officer shot and killed the 12-year-old back in 2014. Authorities say the shooting might have been avoided if the dispatcher told the responding officer that Rice was holding a toy gun. Rice was waving around a pellet gun when he was shot within seconds.
So I absolutely knew what my dad would say when I asked him if I should get a gun now, today, even as a grown adult woman. He said no, but he did recommend I try something else.
You know what would be cool?
What?
A bow and arrow. Now that's something I'd walk around with.
Dad was obviously kidding about me becoming Katniss Everdeen from The Hunger Games, but his comment highlights how absurd this whole idea is to him. And it sounded absurd to me, too, for most of my life. Until I shot that gun in Utah. That's when I realized that it may have been my first time, but it wouldn't be my last.
World peace might feel kind of like a pipe dream, but what if I told you it's not? 2024 will see more than 50 elections around the world. And in some places, peace is actually on the ballot. One reason is because countries in Europe and Latin America have been experimenting with this thing called feminist foreign policy. Because right now, the way that we wage war and peace, it's kind of a boys' club. The new season of Things That Go Boom from Inkstick Media and PRX is coming March 18th. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
I am now at the 12th Precinct Pistol and Archery Gun Range. It looks like I'm going to have to wait for Ahmed because there is a gate and a keypad and I do not know how to enter. But I got here after driving for about 40 minutes. We are clearly no longer in DC. 3 months after Utah, I'm about to shoot a pistol once again. This time in Maryland, about 40 minutes east of Washington, DC, at a private gun range.
Is it all right if it park right here?
Yeah. Okay. I've come to get training from an expert from a Black Gun Owners Association.
Hi, I'm Tamara. Yes.
Esther, nice to meet you.
Esther, nice to meet you.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, nice to meet you.
Ahmed Ahmed is the president of the National African American Gun Association's D.C. chapter, or NAGA. NAGA was founded in 2015 explicitly for sessions like today's, training, safety, and recreation. Ahmed's in his mid-30s, has an athletic build and a dark beard. He reminds me a bit of my brother. He's friendly in a reserved kind of way, and he is clearly in his element at the range. He's got all the gear, and it only takes him seconds to gather what feels like a million things from the back of his Jeep. His wife, Aster, has come along too. She says that she shoots too, but today she is mostly here to soak up the sun. I don't know what I was expecting from a gun owner running a chapter of the Black equivalent of the NRA and his wife, but they are not it.
So yeah, so there's four basic firearms rules. Anyone who ever takes you shooting should tell you these or make sure that you're on the same page. One, treat every firearm like it's loaded. Even if you are 100% sure that it's not, you gotta almost be paranoid. In the time in between you checked and confirmed it wasn't loaded to the time you picked it up, somehow a round jumped into the gun and may potentially make it loaded. So you just treat it like it's loaded at all times, right? So like being cognizant of the fact.
Ahmed walks through the basics and then it's my turn. I point the gun onto a close target. One of those body-shaped ones you see in the movies, about 5 yards away.
Just pull and let go. Perfect. Okay. Now I want you to put that dot directly on the middle of the target.
Okay.
And remember we talked about regarding the trigger?
Yeah.
Put your finger on it and just pull back until you reach the wall.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
All right.
Now remember to breathe and when you're ready, at your own pace.
All right.
Woo! Go ahead and put it down on the table. See?
That wasn't that bad.
That was great. How did it feel?
I like the smell.
I have never heard that one before.
It did smell pretty good, and it felt pretty good too. Seeing that I was enjoying myself, Ahmed decided to up the ante a bit. He had me focus on a small steel target that was 50 yards away. After several tries, I managed to hit it once. I even impressed myself.
Yeah. Let's go. Nice. See? Boom.
I was beginning to get comfortable with this killing machine in my hands. Is this how it happens? Ahmed and I have a lot in common. We're both Black, both former teachers in New York City, now living in D.C. And like me, Ahmed didn't grow up or spend much of his young adulthood around guns. Things changed when he relocated to Atlanta, where gun laws are less strict.
That was probably the first time that I had any type of like passing interest or, to be honest, exposure to firearms at all. And I think it just kind of started with people who were around me who were firearms owners and hearing part of their rationale and reasoning and logic and justification. It kind of makes sense.
At first, Ahmed didn't even know where to go, and he definitely didn't know what gun to buy. Eventually, in 2010, he went to a pawn shop.
And I said that one, and they said, cool. And then they took my ID and then, you know, did some clacking on a keyboard, and 10 minutes later, they put it in a little box and gave it to me, and I walked out.
Alarmingly, it was that easy.
And that was my first bit of exposure.
Now, he's an expert. He competes in shooting competitions in his spare time, and he's a pretty persuasive advocate for responsible gun ownership, too.
So I'm like a pragmatist, right? Like, I did the calculus in my head. I concluded that there are more civilian-owned firearms in this country than there are people.
He's probably right. According to a combination of data, surveys, and other measures from a global study in 2018, there are around 400 million privately held guns in the U.S. That's 70 million more than there are people. It could be more or less. It's hard to put an exact number on it, because the NRA has lobbied against proper data collection on guns for years.
And I think about it like my friends who grew up in New York City who like didn't know how to drive a car. And I'm like, what do you mean you don't know how to drive a car? They're like, I live in New York City. I don't have a car. I don't need a car. I don't need to use it. And I'm like, I don't know. I just feel like you live in a space and time in history in which cars are just like a part of your lived existence. Even if you make the personal choice to not have one yourself, I think like knowing how to safely operate one is probably like a pretty important life skill. You know, kind of like somebody was like, I don't live anywhere near water, so I don't know how to swim. If you live in this country, your proximity to firearms is very, very close. And so being able to know what does safety look like if firearms are in some way around me, I think is like an important skill. And then like beyond that, what does it look like to safely like handle, use one, secure one if you need to?
Guns are all around me, whether I'm aware of it or not. And like cars, guns are a central part of American culture.
I took a look around and did an honest, objective assessment about the United States of America and what is inherently true about it, and came to the conclusion that the right to bear arms is something that has become, for better or worse, good or bad, a very fundamental part of like American existence. If we look at this country in particular, the people who are most disenfranchised when it comes to the Second Amendment are people that look like me, right? And so for me, it came from a standpoint of like demanding equity and equality when it comes to the acquisition of rights. I think that the more people assert that the rights belong to them, the more that we create room for other rights to be asserted and demanded as well.
Ahmed helped me realize that for years, I just assumed that the Second Amendment did not equally apply to me. That I, as a Black woman, should not even consider guns, not just because they are something to fear, but because of how I would be perceived with them. Maybe it's time to reclaim that right. Black gun ownership has a controversial history in America. In the 1960s, the Black Panther Party, originally named the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, developed in Oakland, California, as a way to defend Black people against police brutality.
And there was no government entity that was going to do jack doggone diddly about that brutality.
Professor Carol Anderson is a historian at Emory University in the U.S.
And I study human rights and civil rights, particularly as they affect public policy in African Americans.
Do you have any questions for us before we begin?
No, I understand that we're going to be talking about Black folks and guns and the Second Amendment.
Exactly.
Yes. Yes.
Excellent. Okay.
You've probably seen the pictures of Black Panthers legally carrying large rifles in the streets while dressed in their signature attire, black leather jackets, black sunglasses, and a black beret.
One of their key strategies was openly carrying arms, which the California law allowed, and getting close to police officers who were making arrests of black folk. The police knew that they were being watched. Now, the Panthers knew what the law was. They knew how far away they had to stand from the police officers. They knew the way that they had to carry their guns, and they knew the kinds of guns that they could carry. So they were never breaking the law.
Nevertheless, California State Police were uncomfortable with the Panthers carrying guns.
And they ran to the state legislature, Don Mulford, who was a California assemblyman, and said, you've got to do something about the Panthers. And what they came up with was the Mulford Act.
California lawmakers, backed by the NRA, an organization that normally supports gun ownership, passed a law prohibiting anyone from publicly carrying a weapon without a license, changing the rules for all gun owners because of the actions of black gun owners.
We also see this in the 1968 Gun Control Act that goes after cheap guns, Saturday night specials, the kinds of guns that African Americans who had disproportionately less income could afford to carry. This is the pattern that we see. When you have African Americans bearing arms en masse, you see legislation because we've got to do something about these folk.
But the history of black people and guns goes well beyond the 1960s. Clarence Thomas, who most of us know as the Black conservative justice on the Supreme Court, is a big supporter of the Second Amendment. As a conservative-leaning justice, that is not particularly surprising. What is surprising is his almost black nationalist rationale for it. In a decision for the court in 2010, Thomas wrote, "Militias, such as the Ku Klux Klan, spread terror among blacks. The use of firearms for self-defense was often the only way black citizens could protect themselves from mob violence." The idea is that black people can use the Second Amendment to defend themselves should a group like the Klan reemerge. Go back to Ahmed's point about there being more legally owned guns in this country than people, and the fact that the people owning those guns are largely white. According to the most recent survey by Pew, 38% of white Americans own a gun, compared to a quarter of black Americans. For years, my stance on guns has been that the world is better off without them. But perhaps I should be dealing with the way the world is, not the way I want it to be.
How do you personally carry? Do you conceal and carry?
I do. So I actually carry on my body. I use a comfort concealment belt, and I use my breath as my concealment.
So having looked at some of the reasons why a Black American might want to own a gun, I decided to look at the question through a different lens, as a woman.
And so I teach women that if you're blessed with this, I don't know if it's a blessing or a curse, girl, but if you're blessed with this, then I teach women how to use it as concealment. If not, then we find other ways. There's so many different things that we can do, but I do carry all the time. And if I'm wearing something where I can't carry on my body, then I just carry in my purse. Either way, we're going to get the job done.
Robin Evans is a firearms instructor in South Carolina. She runs Chicks with Triggers, which trains women on gun safety and basics. Robin also happens to be black too.
Can you tell me a bit about why these women wanted to learn?
Girl, turn on the news. So there is a lot going on in the world right now, especially for women, with the rape and the murder and everything going on, you know, the sexual assaults of women. Women wanted to learn how to defend themselves.
For Robin, having a gun isn't just empowering, it's essential. She says that her clients want to be their own first responders. They don't want to have to wait for the police.
More than half of them are domestic violence survivors. That's what Chicks with Triggers has morphed into. It started off as just a self-defense company, and now it's morphed into this whole domestic violence advocacy group. A lot of women have been held at gunpoint. A lot of women have been shot. A lot of women have been raped. I had a woman the other day that she was held at gunpoint, and she had a gun put in her mouth, and he pulled the trigger, and it went through her cheek. And even then, she was still saying, I have to learn how to use a gun. I have to learn how to defend myself because this will never happen to me again. I will never be in that situation again.
But does owning a gun really make you safer? Does being able to protect yourself make you less likely to be the victim of a violent crime? It's so easy to be sure that guns are unsafe, or the opposite, that they are the only safe response to an unsafe world. But what do the numbers say?
Great question, and I'm going to be honest, we don't have the world's best answers. There's a study from the early 1990s showing that homes with a firearm in it, people that live in that home are more likely to die from firearm injury than people that live in a home that doesn't have a firearm in it. But the same could be said for cars or for pools. That's just the highest level of association.
Megan Randy is a doctor and the dean of the Yale School of Public Health. She advocates for a different way of thinking about guns, not as a constitutional right or a partisan fight or an unavoidable part of American culture, but as a factor affecting public health.
Each gunshot wound causes physical damage, and each shot fired also causes emotional damage. When we contextualize it in that way and we think about it as a health problem, we can then apply a public health approach as opposed to a criminal justice or legislative approach to trying to fix this growing epidemic. The culture of fear is part of what is driving this epidemic. It's both driving people to purchase firearms without proper training, which then elevates risk for everybody, and it's changing our culture and our norms in really destructive ways.
Looking at it from this angle, adding another gun and gun owner to the mix means I'd just be making America more dangerous.
We're stuck in this ripple effect where More than half of American adults, according to a KFF survey, say that either they or a family member has somehow been involved in a shooting, has been present, has died of suicide, has been shot at, has witnessed a shooting, has been injured themselves. More than half of us.
More than half? That's shocking. Research from Harvard shows that areas with more guns experience more gun violence. But what does the data say about owning a gun? How often are gun owners the victims of violence? Who is typically at the receiving end of gun violence? Gun owners or non-gun owners?
We have some data, but it's insufficient. And that's largely because we have not invested the resources to figure out what risk and protective factors are. So I can tell you that if you live in a community that has a low socioeconomic status, or if you live in a community that has higher numbers of firearms, you are more likely to either shoot someone, shoot yourself, or be shot. I can tell you that men or boys are more likely to be shot than women, although for women, intimate partner homicide is quite common. I can tell you that young Black boys and men are significantly more likely to die of firearm homicide than young white boys or men.
But that doesn't help with Robin's argument and the argument of many gun owners that the only way to stop a bad guy with a gun is with a good guy with a gun. Some gun owners, 72% of them actually, would argue that people at higher risk have even more reason to arm themselves. America would be better off with fewer guns. That much is obvious. The U.S. has far higher rates of gun violence than other wealthy nations with stricter gun laws. And states within America with looser gun laws experience greater gun violence. Clearly, getting rid of guns entirely is the answer to reducing gun violence. But you can't put the 300-year-old genie back in the bottle. So if you can't beat them, do you simply join them?
I think like this concept of gun ownership is less about gun ownership in and of itself, and it's more about the fight and the struggle for equal access and equal representation. The things that we say we value as a country, that we say is true for Americans. But it's an effort and an attempt to say, let's go ahead and like hold ourselves accountable and say, like, do we really mean this? And if we do mean this, then what does that look like in practice for everybody?
Talking with Ahmed reminded me that when the Bill of Rights and the Constitution were written, we, Black people, were not part of that process. Black people were enslaved, and those who were technically free were second-class citizens. How do we grapple with that reality? That the foundational document in America was written without us in mind. One thought is to really lean into it, really claim the Bill of Rights and all that comes with it.
What do you think about that?
On an intellectual level, I get it.
I decided to test this theory on my dad.
So I think that's a really great point, but then comes down to each person's individual life experience. For me personally, my concern was, okay, you know, I'm carrying a gun. The first impression, second impression, the third impression isn't going to be positive for me.
Right.
No one is looking at me carrying a gun and thinking there's a law-abiding citizen. They're thinking something wrong is going on. And if that person happens to be law enforcement or have the authority to carry weapons, their reaction is going to be shoot first and ask questions later.
As we're talking, I can't stop thinking about Philando Castile.
In another important story, a St. Anthony, Minnesota police officer was charged with manslaughter today for fatally shooting a Black man during a traffic stop. The girlfriend of the victim, Philando Castile, live-streamed the aftermath on Facebook.
In 2016, just outside of Minneapolis, Philando Castile was pulled over by police.
Well, sir.
Good. How are you?
The reason I pulled you over, your brake lights are out. You have your license insurance?
An officer fatally shot him after he said he had a gun in the car.
Sir, I have to tell you, I do have a firearm on me.
Don't reach for it, then. Don't pull it out. Don't pull it out.
I remember I was walking to work in D.C. after I heard the news, and I couldn't stop crying. When I got there, I was so grateful to have a boss who just looked at me, and I knew he understood by how he looked at me. We talked in his office about how hard it was going to be to get through the rest of the day around colleagues who likely had no idea how we were feeling. Then I opened the office door, took a deep breath, and faced the rest of the day. Castile was licensed to carry a weapon, and he disclosed it calmly to the officer at the first opportunity. He did everything right. He was still shot within 40 seconds of the conversation starting.
Now, understand, he wasn't brandishing his weapon. He wasn't threatening the police officer. He merely had a license to carry weapon with him.
The killing of Philando Castile was a pivotal moment for Professor Carol Anderson, too.
I wrote a book called The Second, Race and Guns in a Fatally Unequal America. So let me tell you how I got there. It was the killing of Philando Castile. The NRA went silent with the killing of Philando Castile. The NRA doesn't go silent when legal gun owners are shot down by police officers. And so pundits began asking, do Black people have Second Amendment rights? And I thought, wow, that's one that I haven't looked at.
The idea of having to explain myself to a police officer, sir, officer, there's a gun in the car, as a legal gun owner, terrifies me. These incidents, Philando Castile, Tamir Rice, and the others that stick out in my mind, sure, they're anecdotes. We can talk about the actual likelihood, the probability of getting shot by police. We can talk about who was more likely to get shot and why. But at the end of the day, these kinds of incidents are seared into your mind as a Black person. Maybe the data shows that I would most probably be fine in an interaction with an officer. But do I really want to take my chances? In the words of my father, do I really want to move that needle away from neutral and toward the negative? And so, all of this makes me wonder, is the Second Amendment really meant for me? Carol Anderson doesn't think so.
Regardless of the legal status of African Americans, enslaved, denizen is a midway kind of citizenship, emancipated, Jim Crowed, post-civil rights. Regardless of the legal status, that fear of Black people with guns is a constant in American society.
There is a radical idea, a lesson from the Panther days, I guess, that says that America might get to sensible gun reform sooner if there were more legal Black gun owners. Not because they join the NRA and push it to become more moderate, but because as Americans start to see people they're not necessarily comfortable with legally owning guns, you might start to see more gun restrictions.
I think that's very logical. That's very possible, very probable, because that's also part of the historical pattern.
It's a deeply uncomfortable thought that, nevertheless, like Carol says, seems logical. The more people that do anything deemed extreme tends to make it more moderate. But the idea that this, adding more gun owners to the mix who others might fear, might be the way to gun reform, makes me extremely sad. Will I ever own a gun? It's a question that, when I began making this podcast, I was pretty sure was rhetorical. And now? I can say that when I first saw a gun a few months ago, I was literally trembling. I could barely talk when I saw rifles in person for the first time. Today, I'm a bit desensitized, and I do think that is valuable. When I asked Dr. Megan Ranney, from Yale School of Public Health about her thoughts on teachers carrying guns. She told me there's no evidence that shows that that actually protects anybody. But understanding how to respond in a mass shooting situation and understanding how to hide properly behind something substantial, not sheetrock or a door, and also understanding little things like what kind of gun is it? How much time might I have if the person is changing out a magazine? I can see this as valuable information for the unfortunate world we live in, particularly in the United States. In today's America, every kid has mass shooting drills. But we don't necessarily teach them anything other than locking down, running, hiding, the basics. I think it's important to understand guns, not only to learn how to shoot them, but also to understand how they work. Because whether you like it or not, they're not going away. So I am convinced that I need to learn a lot more about guns. I might even learn how to shoot them better, for fun. Kind of like archery in gym class. And I've been really impressed by the people I've met. These gun owners are incredibly thoughtful about what they are doing and why they are doing it. I almost want to become a gun owner just so I can hang out with them. But do I want to own a gun myself? Should I have a gun stored in my bedside table, ready to protect me and my family in case someone breaks into my home? Do I want to carry one in a holster while walking through the city streets to protect myself in case of a mass shooting?
So I think I know what you're going to say, but
okay.
This whole podcast is about whether or not I should become a legal gun owner. What do you think?
Mm-hmm. I think it's up to you. I think walking in knowing what the risks are, I think getting really trained on it, and that you understand the consequences of using that firearm, because you don't get the benefit of the doubt. The gun is really not your protection. I'm not saying walk around in fear. I'm saying be cognizant of that.
So no, I probably will not actually go and buy a gun. It just isn't for me. At least, not yet.
My dad will be very happy.
Daddies are always looking out for their little girls, right?
Exactly, exactly.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Weekend Intelligence. If you like what you've heard and want to hear more, why not subscribe to Economist Podcasts Plus, where you'll find all of our Weekend Intelligence episodes. This one was reported by Tamara Jilks-Bohr and produced by Stevie Hertz, Gemma Newby, and Tamara Jilks-Bohr. The sound design was by Nicola Raufast. The executive producer of The Weekend Intelligence is Gemma Newby. We'll see you back here on Monday.
What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico is more than just a tropical paradise. It's an innovations paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, Puerto Rico has the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, this is the place to bring it. Find out more at investpr.org/economist.